Dublin's Talking Sport.
Welcome to Dublin's Talking Sports podcast with me, Ken Doherty, and my good friend, Reggie Corrigan. Thanks for tuning in to catch up on the latest GAA, football, rugby, and all the crack. Enjoy the show, and don't forget, rate and review wherever you get your podcasts.
We had another great show this week as we discussed the heartbreak with Stephen O'Brien as his beloved Packers were beaten at the knockout stages in the Super Bowl. Former Irish international Victor Costello talks to me about all things rugby, and we have a look ahead at Ireland's chances in this year's Six Nation. Declan Drake talks all things football as the National League commences this week. And we discuss football with Alan Cawley and whether or not it was a good decision for Wayne Rooney not to take the Everton job. So listen back now wherever you download your podcasts.
Morning, Reg. How are you?
I'm great, thanks, bud. Not a bother at all. Interesting stuff going on in the German Masters, it has to be said. Some defeats that we probably didn't expect. And also a story emerging from there from Mark Selby. We've seen recently that he's been having some battles lately with mental health. But he seems to have made the decision to step away from the game for a little while and just give himself a chance to regroup.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he sort of came out with it a few weeks ago about his mental health, that he's had a little bit of a relapse and doesn't look well, like, you know, and sort of had a little chat with him and that. He's been over here in Germany. He lost a big toe yesterday, 5-4. He sort of needs a little bit of time on his own and sort of get a little bit of help. And hopefully, you know, he'll be back, in full health and playing as well as he was. Of course, he is defending champion of the World Championship this year. He's world number one. Obviously, you know, even with all those titles behind him, you know, he's still, a lot of players are suffering from mental health, Reg, as you know, in your own game. And snooker is affected by that as well.
Absolutely. We wish him well, and hopefully he can get the help that he wants and get back there to the top rankings. But I suppose, it's just people maybe don't quite get it, but like you'd be able to explain it even better. An individual sport adds that extra level of pressure because you've nobody else to blame but yourself, and all eyes are on you when it goes wrong. So it must be.
Yeah, it is. And particularly, as you said, an individual sport, you know, there's a lot of pressure on, a lot of self-pressure as well that you put on yourself, and probably as number one that he is, you know, it's probably even more so, you know, trying to live up to that expectation and stuff like that. He's a good lad, though, you know, Mark Selby. He's one of the good guys, I must say, and, you know, genuine, very, you know, nice fella off, away from the table. So hopefully, exactly that, he can get the help and he'll be back to, you know, to full fitness and hopefully playing as well as he did last year, you know?
Yep, absolutely. We hope he does. Okay, Zhao Xingtang got a pretty strong, big statement out there beating Judd Trump, defending champion. Would that be considered a bit of a surprise?
I think so. You know, I mean, he did win the UK Championship, of course, just before Christmas. He's been playing really well this year. I mean, I remember playing him when he was only 15, you know, over in China, and he beat me as a wild card, you know. Yeah. And he's such a lovely player. I mean, that's no big scalp for him. And anyway, by the way, I just want to let that.
I just want to let you know that before
I go any further. But no, he was 15 when he first started. He got a wild card over in one of the Chinese tournaments a good few years ago. And he's such a great player. He's such a lovely... He reminds me of, like, sort of a Chinese sort of Jimmy White, the way he plays, you know?
Yeah.
He plays... He's left-handed. Hits, strikes the ball beautifully. He's a better head of hair than Jimmy White as well, which always is a benefit, you know. And he's a lovely, lovely player, and he's only early 20s, you know. He's playing. He's in the semi-finals, and his practice partner is in the other semi-finals. Bing Tao, who beat Selby yesterday 5-4, and he beat Ryan Day last night 5-4. He's playing Mark Allen in the other semi-finals. They're both practice partners. They play in the same club in Sheffield. And they're both early 20s. And it wouldn't it be amazing if the two of them could meet in the final tomorrow? It would be quite incredible, you know.
It looks like Jimmy White super glued the clippings of his last haircut onto his head.
Yeah,
it would be a better head of hair than him. That wouldn't be hard,
Ken. It's like that old one, isn't it? You know, Jimmy White spending all day doing his hair and then left it on the mantelpiece, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, well, we're at semi-final stage in the German Masters, so we've got Xing Tong Zhao against Ricky Walden and then Mark Allen taking on Bingtao Yan. Who are you fancying? You were good with Robinson. You got that one right for us. So our lads who like to put on a bit of a bet.
Yeah, I mean, I think Mark Allen, I watched Mark Allen beat Sean Murphy yesterday. He played really, really well. And then, of course, he won 5-0 last night. I think he's playing really well. He'll have a tough match against Bingtao. There's no doubt about that. Bingtao will be playing full of confidence. He was Masters champion, not this year, but last year. He's coming to the fore, as I said. He's only like in his early 20s. He's only 21, 22. But I think Mark Allen, you know, he might be favourite for the championship. But I'm going to go for Xing Tong. I think Xing Tong will get to the final. And I'm going to go for him to win the tournament.
Okay, very good. Yeah, we go with that. That sounds like a plan. What else have you got on this week?
We've got the qualifiers for Turkey, and then of course the shootout was on last week. What a great tournament that was! I don't know whether you caught any of it.
Yes, I did.
But it was fast and furious, and it was absolutely brilliant. Great for snooker in a way, you know. Lots of shouting, lots of roaring, a bit like the darts, but snooker style. And it was really, really good. Now I must say, it was fantastic playing it, and it was fantastic TV as well, you know.
A bit of a surprise victor in the end. I won't try and pronounce his name. You can pronounce it for me. But it certainly seemed that the happiness and joy. And I think even Mark Williams did something during the week with them as a kind of a tribute. What was the winner's name?
Yeah, Hussein Vafai. He's from Iran.
Vafai.
And he was living in Ireland, actually. He was living up in Navan when he first turned professional. Or when he was trying to actually turn professional. He was living in Navan. I'm playing at an Avon Snooker Club for a couple of years. And lovely fella. First time an Iranian has ever sort of won anything as a snooker player. And snooker is like huge in Iran, believe it or not. You know, and he has huge amount of following over there. And when he won the World Amateur Championship, actually, before he turned professional, he got a... from the Iranian, president or whoever it might have been, from the government anyway. He got like gold pieces, like he got like 5 gold pieces or something like that from the Iranian government as winning of the World Amateur Championship, you know?
Nice one.
Yeah. I got five postage stamps from our government when I won the World.
Way out of that. You're still living off the open top bus ride going around the place.
Yeah.
If you're watching any of the golf.
I just want to put that out there if anybody's listening, by the way.
Well, it's too late now. They're not going to give it back to you. They're not going to retrospectively give you 5 gold pieces.
It was 30 years ago. It was 30 years ago, right?
Yeah, no one can even remember. Rory's going all right. Have you been watching any of the golf?
I've been watching a little bit. But yeah. I mean,
Rory's just been 4 shots off the lead.
Larry was playing well last week, and of course, Seamus Power as well.
Yeah,
has been doing really, really well. I've been following his progress over the last, as we both have, you know, over the last couple of years, and it's great to see him do so well. You know, on the American series, on the PGA Tour as well. So it's great to have somebody else there who's sort of been creeping up. You know, he kept his card, didn't he, just by one tournament a few years ago. And now all of a sudden, he's doing really, really
he's
well.
He's in the top 50, I think.
Yeah,
and
that was brilliant. He could be in the Masters as well, in April. Great to see.
Yeah, no, we've been watching very, very closely. His form has been incredible and going really well. Rory's doing well over in the Dubai Classic at the moment. He's 4 shots off the lead. He's teeing off in the third round at 7 under. Porrig is going well there as well. He's just 4 under.
I love Porrig. I love his YouTube videos. He's fantastic.
They are brilliant.
You know, particularly during the pandemic, you know, he's practicing at the back of his house and stuff like that, you know, hitting it over the house, you know, and with a little bit of it, just the way you do, you know.
I don't mean to do it, but like, I do it quite regularly, usually over the clubhouse on the 18th when I'm trying to hit the green. but they're great. He's been doing that between himself now with the videos and videos of his dog Wilson.
A
classic name as well for the dog.
Great. He's fantastic.
He's brilliant. You know, he'll always be the best loved. Okay,
he's a lover. He's a lover of his game, isn't he? You know, you can tell how much he loves
passionate.
The game.
Absolutely passionate, and putting putting green thing up there, Marley Park and everything. It's fantastic what he's doing for the game as well. On and off the pitch.
Absolutely.
It's time to turn our attention to football now. Delighted to be joined on the line by the one and only Alan Cawley. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm good, Reggie. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Very well indeed. Nice busy weekend of sport and plenty going on. I've three matches to go to this weekend, and a couple of training sessions. So it's a nice busy weekend, but we're looking forward to it. I'm in Finglas this afternoon at 1:30, so I'll have to get the Google Maps out there to try and find the football. No doubt we'll get there. No doubt we'll get there. But it's been a busy week in terms of news, maybe not on the pitch, but plenty going on off the pitch in terms of football. So Everton and the saga of Frank Lampard. We see Wayne Rooney has turned down any offers or approaches made to him. Says he's happy at Derby. What do you make of the whole thing?
Yeah, I'm surprised by the Rooney one, Reggie, because I thought if there was an approach made that he would be very much interested because of obviously his connection and his background with the club. And I thought it would have been so tempting that he would have found it difficult to turn down. But as he said himself, he kind of has started something with Derby and he wants to get it finished, and he's doing very well in terms of the fact that they did get the points deducted, and he's bounced back really well from that. And they look like they're in a position now with the form that they've been in recent weeks that he may keep them up, which will be a huge achievement. And in the long run, it might work out better for him that way instead of diving into the Everton situation at the moment, because it looks as though there's a bit of a crisis going on at boardroom level as well. And maybe he doesn't want to get involved in that mess. And it's probably better off if he takes the job down the line if the club is under fine. So I'd say that was his thinking behind it.
Yeah, probably was. And I mean, the Lampard side of it, do you think that's going to happen? Or would it be a good move?
Yeah, well, I think for Lampard it would be a great move, because obviously the Chelsea thing, as we know, didn't really work out for him, but I still think he has plenty to offer Frank Lampard. And something like what we're saying there, the reason why Rooney maybe wouldn't take the Everton job at the moment, I think that's what came against Lampard. He might have taken the Chelsea job too early, in the sense that, again, because of the connection that he has with the club and the background, he probably found it too hard and too difficult to turn down. But was he ready, or was he prepared enough to take a job of that size? Probably not. And that's exactly what happened and why it didn't work out for him. And we obviously seen the difference in the likes of Tuchel and obviously when he came in and the difference that he made. So I think it would be a better starting point for Lampard, because Everton's a huge club, Reggie, as we know. Like, you know, a lot of money has been spent as well. A lot of money's been spent on players. There's huge investment. I know there's a bit of a tussle going on, maybe a boardroom level at the moment, but there's huge potential in the club. So for the likes of him, I think it would be a better move for him compared to maybe Rooney at the moment.
Yeah, indeed. Okay. Declan's in studio here with me as well. Your thoughts on it, Dec?
Yeah, good morning, Al, first of all. Good to talk to you again.
Morning, Declan. We've only 2 weeks to go, Declan.
Indeed. President's Cup final, can't wait. It's going to be some occasion at Tala Stadium. But going back to the Everton situation, I would agree largely with what you say. I think the timing just wasn't right for Wayne Rooney, to be honest with you. And to go into a toxic environment, which it really is at Everton at the moment, wouldn't be good for him. I've no doubt that further opportunities will come later in his career. But the interesting thing about Lampard going there is he's going into an environment now where he's working with perhaps a lower standard of player at Everton, no disrespect to them, than he would have been at Chelsea. And how he copes with that is going to be interesting as well. But I have to say, I do admire Rooney's loyalty to an extent to Derby, the situation that he's in. But as you say, he's turned it around really well in the last few weeks. He's got great confidence, I think, in his own ability to complete the job, despite the very difficult circumstances that he's operating in.
Yeah, and I think with Rooney as well, people sometimes, obviously, maybe a couple of little off the field issues during his career, and he might get a bad press. But I was always a huge admirer of him. Obviously, with his footballing ability, he was absolutely fantastic, as we know. But I think he's a very intelligent person on the game as well. And there was a couple of nights he was on the Monday Night Football and spoke really well and clearly about his ideas on the game. And that's been obviously borne out now since he's taken the management role, because he's obviously done a very good job with Derby. Also, he did a column with one of the Sunday papers, the English Sunday papers, and it was really, really insightful most weeks. So I think he's very good on the game. He's obviously he's cutting his teeth at a lower level, as you say, rather than making the big jump to the pressures and the expectations that would come on him at Everton. Obviously there's expectation and some sort of pressure at Derby, but nothing like what would come on him if he was under the spotlight at Goodison Park. So I think he's going about it the right way, Rooney, and I agree totally as well, Declan. I think we'll see a big future in management with Wayne Rooney.
Yeah, and probably a bit like Ron Nogara is doing with La Rochelle, and you know, Paul O'Connell biding his time. It's probably better to gain real experience at a level you're comfortable at, rather than the complete pressure cooker of a Premier League, or in Ron Nogara's case, Munster in the European Cup.
Yeah, absolutely, Reggie. And we've said this before. I've had this chat with you a couple of times, and using the example of Steven Gerrard, and they're exactly on the same footing, the same level, and O'Gara or O'Connell in rugby was the equivalent of a Rooney or Gerrard in the Premier League, like absolute stars with their clubs. So you take the likes of O'Gara or Munster or whatever, I'm sure when that day arrives, he could walk into Munster and take the job, if he probably wasn't offered it by now. But I love the way he's gone about things and in his coaching kind of map or journey, whatever phrase you want to put on it. And I think that was similar with Gerrard as well, because he could have probably taken a bigger job purely on his name alone. But I listened to an interview a few weeks back with Gerrard, and the humility he showed in the interview, because it's all about Steven Gerrard, the manager now, nothing to do with what he's did in the past or the player. And he's not kind of, I suppose, living off that. If you like, he's focusing now purely on, this is a new chapter, a new career in my life, and whatever I go and achieve, it'll be through hard work, and exactly what he did going up to the likes of Rangers and turning that around. And then you look at him getting the offer of an Aston Villa, and he's on a far better footing to take on a job at that size. And you look at, since he's only there to spend now, and I think he's only going to do even better. And eventually, if that Liverpool job comes along, which I've no doubt it will, he'll be far better prepared for that. So I do think it's the right approach from Rooney, because I think the mistake Lampard made, and I like Lampard, but I think that was a mistake jumping in at Chelsea. And to be fair to him as well, Reggie, it's very probably, it's like, we'll never know, but it's very, very hard to turn down a job of that size, especially with the connection that you have at that club. So I have a little bit of sympathy with him in that regard, that he did take it, but I do think it was a mistake, and he'd probably tell you that himself looking back on it.
Yeah, I think, Alan, as well, Everton are at a serious crossroads here, because they have the new stadium coming up in the next couple of years and that as well. But they need to get this managerial appointment right, not only for the short term to get them through this season and next season, but longer term as well. They've lost a connection with their supporters because of the appointment of Rafa Benitez, which from my perspective was completely the wrong decision to have made at that particular time. So I think you'd agree, isn't it, that the board, you really have to get this one right to get the club united again and drive it forward, because Everton, you know, they are a big club, but they have slipped back a lot over the last couple of years due to bad decisions being made at boardroom level.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you equate, like we often talk about recruitment from a manager to obviously getting good players, the exact same applies from a chairman getting the right manager for a club, certainly in terms of, I suppose, the identity that you want for your club, or strategy going forward in terms of a plan. When they go, I said it was absolute madness, because he was always only, and going forward, he'll only ever be remembered as Liverpool, and that was his link and what he achieved. And for him to take over the Everton job, I thought it was a crazy appointment, and it was always going to end the way it did. They were never ever going to take to him, because you look at the Liverpool fans and the Everton fans, they're very, very passionate people, but they're also very knowledgeable people about the game, and they knew themselves, and they were never going to take to him. So I think, I agree, this is a huge appointment for them. I think they've had 6 managers in the last 6 seasons, so how can you ever gain any consistency or continuity if you're chopping and changing your manager like that? So it's a huge appointment for them, and one they must get right.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, plenty of things happening amongst the Irish contingent. One stands out as well as the 18-year-old James Abankwa, who, of course, has been gone from Pats to Udinese for an undisclosed fee, but he's coming back to finish off his leaving cert. So that's all very positive stuff for players here to see that there's a pathway outside as well if they want.
Yeah, massive news, Reggie, this. And this lad, I'm not sure if many people are aware of him, but he broke on the scene about 18 months ago, really, and with Pats. And a huge, big, big, imposing figure he is. A young lad, plays centre-half, but he played in the cup final then. He made a lot more appearances last season, and he played in the cup final. And I thought he was absolutely outstanding in the cup final. And I thought to myself, there's a lad here with a real future. But I never thought for one second he might go abroad like that, overseas as such, to a club like Udinese in Italy. So when I saw it during the week, it was huge news. And I think it's brilliant, absolutely brilliant for the lad. But I also think it's really good, I suppose, for the league as well, in terms of the exposure and people. And people are tuning in now from not only England. And I also think, obviously, as we mentioned before many times, the landscape changing now in terms of Brexit. And it's not the be-all and end-all now in terms of going away 14. 15, 16, and that obviously can't happen now. He also is getting good guidance if he's coming back to finish off his leaving cert. I think that's a wise move on. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. And in other Irish news as well, we see Kieran Sadlier going to Bolton from Rotherham. So Rotherham, who are bringing in Georgie Kelly, of course, on that 3-year deal. There's movement and interaction going on there, but a good move for Sadlier.
Yeah, well, the Georgie Kelly one, I'm not sure if people know this or should I be saying it, but I played a little bit of a part in that one, Reggie, myself. Because a friend of mine is the assistant manager at Rotherham, and he'd often send me, he'd keep in touch about players and different things. But they were very interested, I knew, in Georgie going back even towards the end of last season and the cup final. So he got a glowing reference from me anyway. Yeah, he got a glowing reference from me, Reggie. But he's a great lad, Georgie, he is. And I think the Bows fans always knew he was going to go somewhere. So I suppose the one thing they didn't want, that he would go somewhere in Ireland, like something what we've seen with Andy Lyons or Mandrew last year. I think that's when the Bows fans really get annoyed, and rightly so, when you see them going to a rival club. But if they're going across to England to better their career or going to a much better maybe opportunity for them going forward, I don't think they'd ever begrudge anyone that. And to be fair to Georgie Kelly, he was brilliant for them, and I think it's a great move for him as well, going to Rotherham. Obviously there's another couple of Irish lads there, and Young Ogbeni is doing very well, so it's a good environment that he's going into. And I think Georgie could go on to much better things as well. He's only young, he has his head well screwed on, very intelligent lad as well, Reggie, so he won't get too carried away with himself. His feet are firmly on the ground, and I think we could see a lot more of Georgie, maybe even representing Ireland one day, because I think he has huge potential.
Just let me get this straight. So Alan Colley, now the bio reads, former player, fashionista, broadcaster and part-time agent. Is there anything that you can't do in there?
Well, the agent thing, I never want to be associated with it. Those agents have bad names, Declan, so I never want to be associated with any of them. But there may have been a word put forward or right about Georgie Kelly. Let's just leave it at that, so, I suppose.
Any SSE or Tristy League manager that sees Alan Colley coming to their games in 2022, beware. Yeah, that's it.
Exactly. Well, they're a very good club. I played with Matt Hamshaw, is the lad's name. I played with him years ago in Sheffield Wednesday, and he's on the staff there with Rotherham. And they're very keen on players here. They often look over and dip into the league. And as I say, with Ogbeni as well, I played a little part in that one also, Declan, going back into when he left. But they do. And you look at, obviously, young lads that have gone away and all, and the potential that's there for them. So why would they not be dipping into the market here, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I think the important thing there is the pathway, you know, good schoolboy development into the SSE or Tristan League and then on. And the good thing about it, as you say, is it's not just all about England anymore. It's Italy and Germany and other places too, which has to be welcomed in terms of broadening player development.
I'm delighted now, as we turn to rugby, to be joined on the line by former Irish and Leinster player Victor Costello. Morning, Victor. How are you?
Morning, Reggie. It's been a while.
It's been a while. Welcome back. For those of our listeners who may not know, you've been living and working in the States for quite a while now, the last few years, but you're back living in Ireland again, and all is good. Great to have you back. You enjoyed your time over there, no doubt.
I certainly did. I got disconnected from rugby, watched it from an objective point of view. I jumped up and down screaming at the TV, with many Americans watching me wondering what I was doing. So I'm back afresh, ready for Six Nations and ready for some live entertaining rugby, and also the ability to sit in a stadium that is full. So yeah, very much looking forward to it.
No, no doubt we all are. It is great to think that we will be going back to those games again. Brings back some memories that have been lost for the last couple of years. And you mentioned America and rugby and looking at you strangely. It's a game that's growing over in America, though, and there's a little bit more interest in it than there was maybe even 5 years ago. Popularity of the game improving?
Definitely so. I think what the Americans are understanding, it never had the razzmatazz that the Big Four had. You know, the basketball, the hockey, the NFL and the baseball. You never had that razzmatazz. And I think a long time ago, they tried to generate that and infect it with it. And that didn't work. But what's happening now, Reg, in the States is that families and parents with young kids, much like the MLS, much like what David Beckham has done for soccer, they're realizing that rugby is a sport that shows great camaraderie and friendships and bonding, whereas the other sports have got probably too commercial and therefore ruthless, and less of the team ethic that rugby can bring. So it's taken a while. It's definitely taken a while, but rugby is definitely growing in America for all of the right reasons, as opposed to the wrong reasons, being injecting money in and trying to get it marketed and trying to get a return out of it. I think for all the right reasons, America is now embracing rugby. And I saw it firsthand when I lived there. I actually was near Iona College, and you can see the bonding between the friends of the squad and their games and their next games and their competitiveness. And it was something that was, you know, in Ireland, in around the start of professionalism, you know, around those 90s days. So there's definitely hope for rugby in America. And, you know, that's not probably good for the rest of the world, because when they start becoming good at something, you know, they'll probably end up being world beaters. But I think also the bid for the World Cup might be happening for 2027, which would be hugely important on the world stage. And that will inject more interest in the game over there. But it's definitely good for the game and definitely good for rugby in America to compete with, as I said, the top four.
That's really interesting that you say that, because, you know, if anywhere has the money to get behind a sport, it's the States, because the, you know, the massive population and the viewership from TV figures and everything else. So is this something that you think, you know, the powers that be, World Rugby, would be looking at this and thinking, you know, for a while there was the idea of maybe some American teams being brought into the Pro 16, and people were kind of scoffing at that idea. But is this something that you think maybe World Rugby, ERC, organisers of Pro 16 should actually be looking at and taking seriously, maybe introducing some of those teams?
Absolutely. And, you know, the connection across the Atlantic in many other areas is very, very strong. The problem with the Americans watching rugby is it's not like where the Big Four split up. So you got 40 minutes of intense activity. And, you know, the marketeers of the game found it hard to kind of produce that and make a day of it. And if you go back to the old days of the Heineken Cup, now I know the Champions Cup is at the moment is causing a lot of controversy, but the old days of the Heineken Cup, it was spread out over the weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You basically had a whole weekend of rugby. The way it is in America is that you do have that in the playoffs when it comes to the NFL, but each game lasts 4 hours. So there's a lot more value for money. And I had this, you know, conversation with people when they talk about the price of tickets for the Aviva. But if you compare, say, the All Blacks prices last November to a kind of a similar event in America, you're probably talking 3-4 times as much. Mm-hmm. So that's the area I guess you don't want to go down, is the marketing end. But in terms of the value of bringing an American side into any leagues over here, you've got the raw talent, you just don't have the skill levels. However, in the pandemic, the skill levels improved like they did across the world, because a lot of people weren't playing games and teams weren't playing games and so on. So it's definitely worth looking at it. But, you know, as I said, the basis of this interest is for all the right values. It's not the money, it's not the marketing. The values of rugby are the friendships, the kind of draw of the camaraderie, the later life bonding, the team bonding, all the right values. And the Americans are not getting those values, Reg, in the other sports. There's a lot of controversy in the other sports. You know, there's obviously a lot of concussion in the NFL. You've got drug use, you know, you've got violence. And that's a lot of negativity around, you know, all the Big Four in America, particularly in the pandemic. They kind of rushed back into full stadium. It was great to see. Yeah. But they were less cautious than the rest of the world getting back, because it's money ball. It's about the money. Yeah. But I think America's got the right values around rugby, the way it was in Europe. And I think it'll be very important to embrace that for the rest of the world. As I said, when they do embrace it fully, they're going to threaten New Zealand and all the top-tier teams. I think that'd be a while off, but certainly the grass roots are there, definitely.
Well, that's very interesting, yeah, because it's certainly the likes of New Zealand, they suffered terribly when Japan came in on the scene with the big money companies buying players from New Zealand, exporting them up, All Blacks, former All Blacks, all finishing off their careers, let's say it, up in Japan, getting huge wages. And as you said, if they start attracting those types of players from the Southern Hemisphere, top world class players, getting a nice little pension plan together for themselves to play maybe 2 or 3 years in the States, a bit like soccer players did when they went to the LA Galaxy and a few different places like that, well then Southern Hemisphere rugby could be damaged by it. So very interesting, we'll have to watch that space over the next while. Moving on from the US to closer to home, as you said, it's great. We're getting Six Nations time. We're getting ready for next week and all that entails. It's been, again, I'm interested, you've been watching from afar, as you said. It's been an interesting time for Andy Farrell. He's gone through the ups and the downs. There's been people calling for his head over the last period of time since he took over from Joe Schmidt. Yet when you look at his record, he's played 19 games in that period of time. They've won 14 and they've only lost 5. It's a pretty impressive record, and certainly of late he seems to have a great balance in that team and a good squad put together.
Yeah, I think at the start, there was a lot of high expectations after the Joe Smith era. But I think as Andy Farrell has moved into the kind of second phase of his international coaching career, I think he's kind of exhausted that. And I think a lot of players who were really good under Joe Smith and played a certain way haven't adapted to the Andy Farrell way of coaching. And that's good in a way, because it's unearthed other squad members from provinces. I know from a biased point of view, he kind of heavily leaned on a lot of the Leinster players recently due to their success. Of course, the more recent squad, not so much, because obviously there's a longevity in the Six Nations and players will come back into form and after injury, etc. But I think he earned the respect. It was a difficult time for anyone in sport to be thrown into a pandemic. You know, the Italy game that started, that stopped, and then they're playing without crowds. But I think his selection and his bond with the team is beginning to show in their performances. And I think it's kind of a less dominant way of coaching. Now, we all know Joe Smith and the success he had and, you know, the Grand Slams, and we got used to that success. But we can't forget we have a World Cup. We have a monkey on our back in the quarterfinals that we need to break. Next World Cup being particularly difficult. But I think the road that Andy Farrell is taking is the slow road, but I think it'll be more beneficial in a couple of years down the road, particularly when you look at the new squad members that he's picked for the Six Nations. But I also see the faith in Sexton as captain. You know, none of this controversy is the Sexton's age. You're the captain, you're the out half, you're a leader, you've experienced that set in stone early on. So I think he's managing as a player. He's managing his players like a player, and I think that's going to benefit Ireland. But I do think there are some players that have struggled from the end of the Joe Smith era, which he's had to contain with, that haven't really come back to form, I guess, the way they should have.
Key areas like hooker have moved on with the likes of Kelleher. The moving of Porter into loose head prop has been a huge success, because Cian Healy, who's been an amazing servant to Irish rugby, is probably getting to that age now, as we all do, where he's not quite as effective as he was. But Porter coming in there has made a huge difference. Ryan seems to have found his form again in that second row. He's got a plethora of back row players that he's able to call on. That form is amazing. Then you've got Jameson Gibson-Park, who's playing at 9 and has picked up the form exceptionally well as well, and a back line that's on fire as well. Going into this, could we say that Ireland should be one of the favourites? I know France are red hot, England are always difficult away from home, but it feels like this is an Irish team that could go and win this championship.
Yeah, well, you speak about the front row there, Reg, right? And I mean, arguably, we could have the best front row in the world. Yeah. You look at Cian Healy coming on for matches, and you look at the amount of caps he has and experience and what he can provide. Arguably, we have the best back row in the world. You know, there are seriously quality players that can't get into that back row and maybe shouldn't for a while. You talk about James Ryan back in the form. There's a lot of second rows. Then you go into the kind of back line, the skills the back line have, in all provinces, you know, and you only have to look at that squad, that Irish squad, and think of the players that have been left out of that squad. Serious quality. So The last time, prior to a couple of years ago, you always thought you wouldn't win a Grand Slam when you're away to England and away to France. And I think that kind of mirrors the World Cup, you know, next year. You know, they won it beating England away, and of course that famous drop goal from Johnny Sexton in 2018 in this kind of away to the hardest teams fixture. Mm. So why can't they do it again? Well, I think they'll beat the English. Will they beat the French? The French are loose. They're very, very dangerous, and their trajectory is very, very high. But if you're going to think about beating any of the top-tier teams in the quarterfinal of the World Cup next year, you got to go win in France. So I think psychologically and physically and skills and coach and team and squad, I think we're in a really, really good place. Plus, we're coming off the back of a lot of good victories, a lot of good momentum, a lot of good performances. Of course, there's a couple of quirks that need to be changed, but I think psychologically, this Six Nations is going to be very, very important. And, you know, if you have to look at 2018, at the end of Six Nations in 2018, we were top dogs, number one in the world, fantastic Six Nations, Grand Slam winners. What happened between that and the year, the World Cup the following year? It was in Japan. We had a reasonable group, and we thought we were going to cruise all the way to a semi-final. Now we know we have to compete in the quarterfinal next year. So what are we going to do about it? Think ahead. We're 18 months away. How are we going to do this? Well, you got to beat England at home, and you got to beat France at home. That's a good start. And then let's look at the tour in the summertime and keep the momentum throughout the next season. So I think it's set up really, really well. I think it's going to be very exciting. I think the crowds back will have a huge importance because, you know, crowds haven't been to Six Nations. We all know, we spoke about money there, Reg, in marketing in rugby. The Six Nations is almost the last bastion of hope in a traditional cultural competition that has provided so much fun. As we all know, it gets you through the winter months. It starts in the winter and finishes in, you know, spring. So I think it's hugely important to everyone, not just the team, the coaches, but also the fans. And I think they're going to see a different fan dynamic in the Aviva next week when people are just so happy to be back in a cultural game. So I think there's a lot of pressure, but there's a lot of nice pressure and a lot of little goals to achieve along the way, starting the next weekend. So I think we're really in a good place. We're really in a good place, Ireland. And you know, there's an argument that you don't look at the World Cup next year. You just focus on the game ahead. But I think Andy Farrell, with the squad he picked, is looking down the road further than probably any coach did in the past.
Yeah, just finally then, Victor, I wanted to get your thoughts on the coaching setup. So in recent times, whether it's been imposed on him because of financial restrictions by the IRFU or whether it's a deliberate ploy by Andy Farrell, he has sort of slimmed down the coaching staff and roles have been double jobbing. So Simon Easterby, for example, has taken on the defensive role as well. But adding to the squad, he's brought in high performance expert Gary Keegan, who seems to be doing well on a consultancy basis, but also Paul O'Connell. There seemed to be a notable difference in Ireland's lineout when Paul O'Connell came in. So, you know, argument again that someone of his experience was a shrewd appointment and has benefited Ireland no end.
That's one of the things I mentioned before that I like about Andy Farrell. He's not afraid to make changes on the team or on the coaching staff. And he has become a little bit ruthless, and he has become more ruthless with that coaching ticket, as I say, you know, for the next 18 months, certainly. Paul O'Connell came in and injected a massive change to the lineouts. The lineouts for a decade, and you and I discussed it off the air, have been a lottery. You know, we haven't been guaranteed our own ball, and at this level, you have to be. There have been teams that have watched us being vulnerable in lineout all the way through provincial level and also an international level. And it's happened so many times against Wales, particularly in Wales. So Paulie bringing in that kind of, obviously the experience he has, the ruthlessness he has, the kind of competitiveness he has to the technique of throwing, but also competing, has totally changed our lineout. And it has given our backline the freedom then to run off quick-paced set-piece ball and maybe the odd stolen ball, because not only were we struggling in the line-out in terms of the stats, but we weren't competing really on opposition ball. We are now. And that's a huge weapon to have. And people are calling for Paulie and, you know, Ronan O'Gara for the Munster team. But I think the two, you know, RX colleagues, I think they're doing really, really well learning their trade. Mm. And another Six Nations, you know, again, at Paul O'Connell's trajectory from last season, I think he'll be even better this year. But from Andy Farrell's point of view, the coaching colleagues he has, they need to be changed. And, you know, as you said, double jobbing. You got Simon Easterby, who's a defence coach. You've got Andy Farrell, who was a world-renowned defence coach. So people need to know their roles. The players need to know what their coaches' roles are and who the dominant force is, who's the boss in whichever area. And that's then you get a well-structured, well-disciplined outfit. And as I said, when you talk about it like that, Reg, we're in really, really good shape. So we'll start well. We have a lot of little mini goals here, but also a wider objective. So I think it's really, really positive from an Irish point of view. And again, once again, without over-emphasizing, great to have the crowds back. It is so important to players to run out into a full stadium. It brings that passion. It gets that the juices flowing. And, you know, if we touch back in America, we know how what a pride nation they are. So, you know, with the Eagles and all that singing for their anthem. All that back into the game, into the mix, added to the passion that obviously Paulie brings, and obviously Johnny Sexton, very passionate at half and player. I think it's going to be a great, great Six Nations, and I cannot wait for it to start.
I can't.
The hairs on the back of my neck. As
thinking about it, I know, it's going to be exciting. I can't let you go because you've brought it up yourself. Well, one more question. It's the one that everyone's talking about. You've said it. Amazing front row, probably first best in the world. One of the best back rows in the world. A back three that are threatening everything. Jemison Gibson Park playing great rugby. A centre partnership that's, you know, seems to have found its form again and it's causing holes in defences. Johnny Sexton, the great servant of Irish rugby. The question everyone's asking, he can't go on forever. Where is the replacement going to come from? I mean, we're looking at Harry Byrne, Ross Byrne, Jack Carthy. There's a lot of lists there, but no one seems to be getting the opportunity, maybe, or stepping up to the plate. Where do you see it going, or that 10 position?
Thank you very much for that question. I have two minds in that question. First of all, our trains of thought. First of all, Johnny Sexton, he is our best out of half at the moment. Do not question his age. Do not question his commitment. Let him get on and play. When the day comes that he gets an injury, God forbid, or his performances decline, then we look and see who's there. You cannot replace the man just yet. We have loads of options. You've mentioned the two Byrnes, Ross Byrne particularly, Harry Byrne. Joey Carby's in the squad, again, injured, has not proven to me, and I don't mind saying this, that he is a viable backup because he hasn't had the time to pitch. And I know Ron Nagara said that. That's another day's conversation. But when the time comes, they will pop their heads up. We don't need to look for one now because Johnny Sexton is arguably one of the world's best out halves, and he's starting and he's the captain. But when the time comes, players will step up. We have the players there. You see Jack Carty, he's even back in form. But you've got the two Byrne brothers. Them fighting between each other is going to be good for Ireland and Leinster. So I'm not concerned about this. I know there was a lot of talk about it, a lot of talk about his age. He compares himself to Tom Brady. Totally different sport. You can't do that. However, he is the best out of half. Let him play. Let him get on with the Six Nations. If the situation happens, we'll deal with it then.
GAA with Declan Drake on Dublin's Talking Sport.
We start with football and congratulations to the Dublin footballers who last Saturday secured the O'Byrne Cup at the expense of Laois at Netwatch Cullen Park under the on-field leadership of Castleknock man Kieran Kilkenny. That brought a successful conclusion to the four-game pre-season competition, which earlier saw victories over Offaly, Louth and Longford. But tonight, the serious business of 2022 gets underway with the start of the Alliance National Football League. Dublin have a Croke Park date with newly promoted Armagh in Division 1 from 7:30. This year, of course, the league back to normality after last year's truncated season, which only started in May and was run on a geographic north-south basis. It's a game which features two managers who played on a very successful Nafina team many years ago in Desi Farrell and Kieran McGinney. Now, joining me to cast his eye over tonight's game and what this league means for Dublin is Nigel McCarthy of We Are Dublin. Well, first of all, Nigel, good morning and welcome back to Dublin's Talking Sport. Okay, well, as I mentioned at the start there, the O'Byrne Cup was a successful campaign, which, you know, has helped Desi put the early pieces of the 2022 jigsaw together. What did you take overall from that batch of games, Nigel?
Good morning, Declan. Yeah, great to be back.
Now, as I mentioned at the start there, the successful O'Byrne Cup campaign, in many respects, you know, it's helped Desi put the early pieces of the 2022 jigsaw together. What did you take from the batch of games overall?
Basically, what I would have taken from the batch of games is, you know, Desi set out to have a look at some new talent. We've had a lot of players retire over the last number of years, including some that just recently announced their retirement. So, you know, he has to replenish the squad. And, you know, look, those four games gave him the perfect opportunity to have a look at the young talent that's available coming up from, you know, the underage system over the last couple of years. And look, it was great to win the competition. It's the first silverware 2022. But I think overall, over the four games, the best thing to come out of it was to get plenty of game time into these, you know, new players that have come into the squad, get some game time into the old stagers as well, just ahead of the National League. And, you know, as I say, yeah, brilliant to win the competition. But I think overall the main thing was to, you know, see what Desi has available, you know, for the league and going forward into the Championship.
Yeah, I think myself, he got the mix fairly right throughout the course of the competition between the experienced players and then the younger guys coming in. And from the younger players' perspective, to win a medal in a Dublin shirt, okay, it's the Auburn Cup, but still, it's your first senior medal, and it's one to be respected, of course. Now, this year, as we know, Nigel, Dublin are back in the pack, so to speak, at the start of the year in terms of not being the All-Ireland champions, and that takes some getting used to, I can tell you. What do you think are the realistic expectations about this league from a Dublin perspective? What will Desi look to take from it?
Well, first thing, he wants to, particularly if he's using some of these, you know, new players in it, he wants to embed into them, you know, particularly psychologically, that winning mentality. You know, that was one of the main ingredients under Jim Gavin that the squad had, you know. So he'll be trying to do that. Again, it depends what way Desi looks at the league, to be honest. Does he look upon this to just get some more game time? At, you know, look, the O'Burn Cup is the O'Burn Cup, but it's only Leinster teams they played against. And we know that the Leinster Championship itself, you know, outside of Dublin, the quality hasn't been, you know, of the highest grade. So, you know, during the league, they're going to come up against teams that will be contenders for the All-Ireland later on in the year. So, you know, give these players some experience. You know, see how the older guys are as well, you know, because a lot of them have a lot of mileage under the bonnet, you know, so he might look to pick and choose when to play them as well. As you said, he got the mix of youth and experience correct during the O'Burn Cup. I think he'll do the same during the league. Look, he's going to go out and try and win the competition, there's no doubt about that. But, you know, if he doesn't do that, if he can get that balance right, correct, going in ahead of the Championship, I think he'll look upon that as a successful league, you know.
I'm just thinking, are we fortunate enough that we didn't lose perhaps one or two more along the way as well? I'm thinking in the lines of James McCarthy. It was great to see him commit his future to the Blues for another year again.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, look, we had that golden generation of players, and, you know, slowly but surely we're losing them one by one. And yeah, look, it was great to see players like James still around and a number of others that did stay on. You know, we lost Philly McMahon just a couple of weeks ago. We've lost other players, as I said, over the last couple of seasons. So, you know, you need those, I keep saying the word old, but old experienced heads in there, particularly when you've got young guys coming into the squad, because, you know, it's players like James and those that will push these guys on. It'll also, you know, they'll be able to see from them what's expected from a Dublin player, what's also needed to be as successful as players like James and the other guys were. So, you know, you can't buy that experience. You can't buy what they're going to bring to the squad during the season. So, yeah, look, it was great to see them stay on.
Thank you, Nigel, for joining us on the programme this morning, and we look forward to catching up with you soon. We turn our attention now to Club Fair, and a huge occasion this evening for our county and provincial senior club football champions Kilmacud Crokes, who contest the All-Ireland semi-final at Kingspan Breffni Park from 5 o'clock, with Roscommon and Connacht Kingpins Pádraig Pearses. The purple and gold travel north, having had a fine Leinster final success over Naas at Croke Park 3 weeks ago. Double scores victory in the end for the Stillorgan outfit, indeed keeping the Kildare champions scoreless in the second half. One of the more impressive aspects of it was the ability of different players to step up to the plate when required, particularly in the absence of Paul Mannion. Last time out it was Tom Fox, a real man of the match performance there, kicking 5 points at Croke Park.
We wish Robbie Brennan and the Kilmacud Crokes team every success in their endeavours to reach the All-Ireland final this evening, and indeed safe travels as well to those making the trip north from Stillorgan. Finally, on the football front this week, great news for both St Jude's and St Sylvester's, our junior and intermediate club champions in ladies football, who last week qualified for their respective finals of the current account.ie All-Ireland Club Championships. Both those finals will be played next weekend. First up on Saturday, junior Queens St Jude's must travel to Baltinglass to take on Mullinahone of Tipperary at 1:30, while the following day St Sylvester's will travel west to take on Castlebar Mitchells in their final at Duggan Park in Ballinasloe, that one throwing in also at 1:30. We will have plenty of build-up to those two games in the programme next week. We turn our attention on the programme now to hurling, and while last week saw the completion of the pre-season Oberon Cup competition in football, today it's the turn of hurling. The Walsh Cup final takes place at Croke Park with a 5:30 start between Dublin and Wexford. Dublin with a 100% record coming into this game, three straight wins over Offaly most recently last Sunday, and previous to that Galway and Antrim. And the bonus, of course, is that this final is being played at Croke Park this evening ahead of the Dublin Armagh Allianz National Football League game. Joining me to look ahead to this game now this evening is our regular hurling analyst, Sean Lane. Welcome back to the programme. Sean, good to see you again. How are things?
Very good, Declan. Good morning to you.
OK, now the team was announced last night ahead of this game this evening, and we've spoken a lot recently about the opportunities being extended to new talent to stake claims in the team for league and championship. Two of them have certainly taken it very well, it seems, in particular young John Bellew of Lucan Sarsfields at cornerback and Aidan Mellett at the other end of the pitch from Ballyboden St Enda's. What do you make of those two inclusions for a start?
Well, I think it's great to see new blood, and you know, going back, as I said, I listened to your interview with Matty. He told us he was going to look at new players. He told us he was going to give them a run. I saw young Bellew playing. He's done nothing wrong in the three games, so you look, I'm delighted Matty's given him a start. And Aidan Mellett, I've watched him playing a lot of club hurling with Ballyboden. He's when he's on form, he's damn good. So it's great to see new players and new blood coming in, and you've got a few of the young Curries and the subs and all of that. So I welcome this. I think it's great.
Looking at the positioning of certain players as well, Paddy Smith, Clontarf, centre half back, used to being behind that position in the full back line, and Chris Crummy at midfield. We've had a lot of debate about where Chris should play over the last number of weeks. He's selected to play at midfield this evening, but what are your thoughts on those two positional choices by Matty?
Well, take Paddy Smith firstly. I think he's a very competent hurler. He's very fast. He has great stick work, great man to distribute the ball. You know, maybe his hands are tied a little bit behind his back playing cornerback, so there's a little bit more space from there and to throw the ball around. I'd be comfortable with it, but obviously we'll have to see how he plays. Chris Crummy, I mean, to me that's always been the dilemma. Do you play Chris in the backs or do you play Chris in the forwards? And we've said this before, Chris will never let you down the forwards. He'll always get you a couple of scores. But I've always asked myself the question, could Chris Crummy dominate a game, you know, even like Deshaun Morden did in his good times? Could he? Well, it's a very strange one. I've done it myself, Declan, in club games where a good midfielder is a good ball winner in the half-forward line, and he's also a very, very good man to win a ball in your half-back line too. You know, when the opposition is poking the ball out, he's a half-back, and when you're poking the ball out, he's a half-forward. And Chris has the engine on him. He's going to get up and down the field. So, look, at it's again, it's a new way that Matty's looking at the team. We've said all along that he's improved. He got to the quarterfinal last year. He beat Galway in the championship. He got to the Leinster final against Kilkenny, and we had an awful day with COVID and Owen O'Donnell going off, and we weren't beating a lot. We were beaten by a better team on the day. So he's improving all the time. You know, I think a couple of positional switches, a couple of new personnel, you know, we could have a good season.
When the fixtures came out for this competition, I mean, he would have earmarked at least getting to the final from the point of view that, to two points of view really. One is confidence in the team, because winning obviously generates confidence. But two, getting another competitive game in a week before the start of the serious business, which is the National League against Waterford at home a week tomorrow.
Yeah, absolutely, and there's no doubt. If you even just take the last game, they had an exceptionally good result against Galway. They beat them really well and looked very strong, and Donald Burke got 18 points, so my God, that's, people wouldn't get that in four or five games, so that's a fantastic. But even against Offaly, it impressed me. You know, Offaly threw it up to them, and I watched the game, they threw it at them, and Dublin found themselves 4 points down at half-time. But they still had the power to come back and beat Offaly 10 points the second half. And Offaly under Michael Fennelly, as we know, they're making huge strides. They're, after winning the Christy Ring, they're coming through the ranks. They're working very hard in Offaly. So to beat Offaly over 35 or 6 minutes with extra time by 10 points against an Offaly team that was trying really hard, I think that's good. And as I said, I think we're in a very good position for tonight and equally for the first National League game against Waterford on Sunday week.
Of course, it would be fantastic if they could win the game. But I would say to you, perhaps overall, that performance levels are considerably more important. Would you agree?
I would. I mean, ultimately, Matty is trying to get the best 20 players for the championship. And ultimately, the best way to get that is to have the best teams for the 5 National League games. But I mean, tomorrow's opposition are Wexford. They have a new manager in Dara Egan. He's putting some, I'm sure you've seen the backroom team. He's putting boxing lads in Billy Walsh, and he's putting Gordon Darcy from rugby in his backroom team. You know, they're going to be trying really, really hard. Conor McDonald's back to a bit of form. He got 6 grey points against Kilkenny. In a game, I might point out that we had a Dublin referee refereeing the match, Thomas Gleeson. So great from the Naifumbra club to have a referee refereeing at that age, or that level. So yeah, look, I honestly think it's a great game to have. It would be brilliant to lift the silverware, and I think we can just about do it. But we're going to come up against a right struggle against Wexford, because the new managers want to put a marker down to say, you know, we're things have changed here in Wexford, and we're going to be trying very hard, and I believe they will.
NFL now, so we're going to be talking to Stephen O'Brien. He joins me on the line. Good morning, Stephen. How are you?
Not good, Reg. Yes. I was going to call in sick today after the Packers' performance last weekend. Thanks for having me on.
Yes, I am so sorry, because we were very confident is the only way I can describe it. I mean, at the very start of the season, you called it out. We were looking at, 13, 14 to 1. They were pre-season to lift the Super Bowl, and we were excited about it. Everything was on track. Last week, we were bigging them up because they were firm favourites to win. What happened?
Everything. If you look at any of these sort of programmes, Reg, where, and I hate to say it, and hopefully no one's listened to this on an Aer Lingus flight, but anytime a plane goes down, right, it's never a wing falls off or an engine falls off or the tail falls off or the pilot gets sick. It's always a sort of a cataclysmic event of like 10 things that go wrong. Again, the Packers kind of did that in this game. And I put out on my personal Twitter, as I'm likely to do, that the Packers were firm favourites, and I'm going to call it ahead of time that we would smash the Niners. Now, I had a world of pain, obviously, after that. Like Colin Meaney says in intermission, I had to take me scolding after the game because I got hammered. But the thing is, I still stand by that sentiment. The Packers, this was all to win for the Packers. They were at home. It was coming up against the Niners team. Jimmy Garoppolo was injured in 2 places. He had a shoulder injury, a thumb injury. He's not that great anyway. Come at me if you think that that's not true. Look at his stats. They're atrocious. And then also, their top defensive players, Reg, were coming off concussion protocol. And one guy looked like he got his ankle snapped in half in the prior game, but he ended up playing and actually made a pivotal role, Fred Warner, and punched the ball out. So it's inexplicable. Like, the Packers' special teams were pretty bad all season. And people were saying, look, this is going to cost the Packers down the line, especially when you get into the playoffs and, like, it comes down to fine margins. And you'd think what would happen was is that on a kickoff return or a punt return or something, that they'd fumble the ball or that the other team would advance further down the field than they would. We never thought that what would end up happening was it would turn into actual points, which was a blocked field goal, which we missed 3. I say we as if I played for the team. And then on the punt block, then that went in for a touchdown for the opposite team. To give an example of how shocking it is that the Niners didn't score a single point on offense or defense. All of their 13 points, which is a dismal score to begin with, came off special teams, which is a pretty incredible stat, especially when Aaron Rodgers, who's just won the MVP award for the second year in a row, can't get it done at home and get over the marker of 13 points. By point standards, and I'll stop here because the whole show will be taken up and you'll have to cancel all your other guests. To be 13 points, it's one of the worst postseason performances by any team in the playoffs at home not to be able to overcome a 13-point thing. So the Niners did not beat the Packers, in my opinion. The Packers beat themselves, and the stats bear that out, Reg. And yes, it's sour grapes, and yes, I was sort of upset. You know, like, I usually have a co-host on my podcast, but I went on for 40 minutes on my own on the last episode, which I'll go to show you. So instead of doing that on this show, I'll park it there for the Packers talk.
Yeah, it's hard to take. I understand it entirely, especially when your team are that much favourites, you know. But you weren't alone. The Tennessee Titans had another shock defeat in their game too.
Yeah, I mean, look, it was a really wild weekend. There was only one game where the top seed or the favourite, the home team, actually got through. So the four games, only one of them was the person who was tipped to get in. Now, when we did Araka, I picked the Rams to beat the Bucks. That actually happened. You know, I had some people would say a broken clock is right twice a day, right? I was sort of thinking it was one of those games that was kind of set up that way, I thought, and that came through. But yeah, the Titans got knocked off. I mean, the number one seed. And what happens when you're the number one seed? Well, A, obviously you're the best team in that conference, in that division. And then also you get a week off to rest and you get your players back. And they got Derrick Henry back, who's this bruising back who was expected to jump out of the ice bath onto the field and dominate. And that didn't happen. They come up against the Bengals. And again, all of these games seem to come down to the wire. It was all like a field goal. We saw the Chiefs game was just pure wild. But in the Titans game, the Bengals, 52-yard field goal. And the guy who kicks it is a rookie. So he ends up winning the game for them. Again, it comes down to sort of pivotal plays. And this is what we talk about all the time, Reg, when we talk about any given Sunday. So there was crucial moments in this game, like the Titans being stopped in 4th-and-1 instead of just kicking a field goal to lead that game by 3. You know, Tannehill gets picked off with 20 seconds left in the game. He gets picked off on 1st-and-goal at the Bengals 9-yard line. And then the quarterback, Joe Burrow, for the Bengals, who haven't won a playoff game to get into the championship, after being sacked 9 times. A team hasn't done that since the 1966 team ran by Len Dawson. So it just goes to show this guy got sacked and put on the ground more times than anybody this year, but was still able to overcome that to get into the next round. So just an absolutely bonkers game. You know, they should not have. Well, they're a great team, so I'm not saying they shouldn't have won that game, but the Titans were tipped to win that game. And now it's the first Bengals championship game in 33 years, which is incredible stuff.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. But I mean, last weekend, speaking of incredible, it really gave all the fans value for money. Every game came down to the wire. But the Chiefs and the Bills game, that was considered the wildest. The Bills losing in overtime, were ahead with only 13 seconds left on the clock. They were ahead.
It makes no sense, Reg. It's what I watched it back again this morning just to get that feeling of awe back in my bones. It was just unbelievable. You know, this is. The Bills, unreal. Josh Allen has really come into his own as a quarterback. The guy's super dynamic. He's not, you know, people don't give him the credit that he deserves for sort of legging it about the place and getting that first down, but he did that so many times in this game. It just went back and forth. The game was tied all game. And then the Chiefs go down and they lead the game and it looks like that's it for the Bills. But then with, as you say, 13 seconds left in regular time, Josh Allen throws this unbelievable pass. It's a touchdown. They lead the game. It only leaves Patrick Mahomes 13 seconds to basically go the full length of the field. There was all these videos going out, and I really feel bad for them, of the Bills fans jumping up and down as you would, saying, you know, we got this. I cannot believe we've actually got this far. We've beaten the Chiefs finally, and what a nail-biter of a game. But then the Chiefs go all the way down the field in 13 seconds, and they end up, Travis Kelce, of course, catches the ball, and they score that field goal, which brings it into overtime. And this is where this kind of gets controversial too, is that it was such an incredible game. Two fantastic quarterbacks going back and forth, trading blows, trading touchdowns and field goals and everything else. But the overtime rules mean that whoever gets the ball into overtime, whoever scores a touchdown, it's a walk-off touchdown. The other player doesn't get a chance to touch the ball. But if they score a field goal, then the other team can come on and try to score their field goal. But basically, it's like the golden goal. Whoever scores that touchdown wins. And that's exactly what happened. Josh Allen never got to touch the ball again for the Bills. Patrick Mahomes wins. The coin toss comes on. And of course, Travis Kelce again in the end zone gets a touchdown. So we never got to see Josh Allen come onto the field again. And there's a real good image of him sitting on the bench looking distraught, kind of just sitting there accepting the loss. because he never got a chance to touch the field again. And people said that that's not fair, that they need to at least give the other team a chance to get back on the field. But as you say, literally one of the best games in years. So it's worth going back and looking at the highlights of that even now, because it's incredible.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, we're down to the last four teams battling out for a chance to be in with the Super Bowl. As they stand now, how are you seeing things? Who is now your favourite?
Well, we'll throw in the ACA while we go. Look, it's the Chiefs going up against the Bengals. The Bengals have just an atrocious O-line. Joe Burrow got sacked 9 times and still won the game. He's only the second player in NFL history to actually do that in a playoff game after getting sacked that many times. And the Kansas City Chiefs, what's really intriguing about this thing is that Joe Burrow is unbelievable. He's breaking records as in his second year coming in here doing the business, especially coming off knee injuries and everything else. But they're underdogs at 7.5 to the Kansas City Chiefs. And I just feel that the Chiefs have been here before. As we just talked about, that Bills game was incredible. Patrick Mahomes delivers in these moments. So they're 7.5-point favourites. So I would put them down as winning this game. So that's that for the ACA. And also I put them down as winning the Super Bowl as well at this stage. And we were only talking earlier in the season, weren't we, Reg, about how they were faltering. People didn't know what was going on. Had they figured out Patrick Mahomes? It seems like that's all gone to the wayside. And then the other game is the Los Angeles Rams coming against the San Francisco 49ers. This is Steve O'Sara Grapes here. But the San Fran 49ers, they're not a great team. They have some fantastic weapons. Of course they do, and Debo Samuel and everything else. But I just feel that the Rams, they're not that much favoured. It's only -3.5 here. But I'm going to go for the Rams because I think the Rams actually have that X factor as long as Stafford doesn't have any of those brain fart moments. So they're 3.5 favourites. I'm going to go for them. Anything could happen in both of these games. And I could get on here and we could be talking about shock losses again. But there's only a 2.5 odds to that because of the small amount of games. So if you put a tenner down, you get 36 back. But I'm going to go, as it stands, for the Chiefs to take the top spot and to win the Super Bowl in the end. But it's going to be two really intriguing games this weekend, Reg, and they're both on telly on Sunday. So definitely worth a watch.
Excellent stuff. Well, Stephen, commiserations again. So sorry Thanks. That the Packers couldn't deliver in the year that seemed like it was definite. But that's the way it goes. And we'll chat to you again next week.
Thanks for listening to Dublin Stock and Sport on Sunshine 106.8 from myself, Ken, and Reggie. Have a good weekend.